people are angry, then they realize there's going to be the range of possible outcomes, whether it's custody, financial, or something else. So everybody's better off if we can all reach a reasonable solution. And in enough time, you get there.
Are you ready? Are you sitting down?
Season 4 of the Shine On Podcast, absolutely terrific guest. My take on what's happening in the world of divorce. Are the stakes high? You better believe it. The unfiltered and real take on what divorce is like from the absolute best professionals. Life, love, marriage, divorce, relationships, finances. Topics that far too often many people shy away from. But not here on the Shine On Podcast. It's episode 74 of the Shine On Podcast. I'm Evan Shine. We have an absolutely tremendous featured guest spot on the podcast coming up shortly. And after the docket, I'm joined by Lisa Johnson and Chris Barrett. They're authors. They're divorce coaches. They are the co-founders of Been There, Got Out. Lisa and Chris do it all, and they're fantastic. Producer Dave, we talk about this all the time. We have great guests on the podcast, but this interview with Lisa and Chris, it was as good as it gets. They were tremendous.
Yeah, I felt like we were sort of hanging out in their living room just talking about life, and there is just not a dull moment. They've lived it. Now they teach it or coach it or whatever, and not only do they give great advice, but they're also just clearly salt of the earth people and funny, by the way.
And speaking of tremendous and funny, I'm going to insert it over to you, Producer Dave, because I know you have a great docket lined up. So as we always do, let's fire it up.
And now, let's see what's on the docket.
Great edition of the docket, starting with something that happened at a Drake concert, which comes to us from People.com.
Item one.
Headline in People.com reads, Drake offers to pay for fans' divorce proceedings mid-concert. What? We actually have the footage here, Evan. Take a listen.
What we got to do, get you a lawyer or something? I'm going to get you a good lawyer. We're going to pay for your divorce tonight. You're going to be single and ready to end it.
That's right. Right in the middle of the concert, Drake offers to pay for his fans' divorce and tells her, you're going to be single and ready to mingle. Your thoughts on this moment, Evan, what do you think?
Dave, I got to tell you, I love everything about this. And it's not because I know that you're a big fan of Drake's music. It's because, wow, you talk about generosity. You talk about good deeds. You talk about looking out for others and giving back. Drake nails it. And as the article talks about, it's not the first time. And look, divorce is expensive. So for anyone out there who's listening or wondering or even questioning, is this really that generous? Let me tell you, it's extremely generous. It's not uncommon for divorces to cost upwards of six figures. So it is incredibly generous of Drake.
For sure. It's just what you would expect from my favorite African-American Canadian Jewish rapper. He's quite a guy. And Drake is probably one of the few people that can offer to pay for an entire divorce on the spot. I think he's got the funds.
And Dave, speaking of single and ready to mingle, I thought he was talking about you.
Yeah, if Drake had offered to pay for my divorce, I might be taking my dates on to more expensive places. But I do my best, Evan. I do my best. Let's move off of my dating life, Evan, if you don't mind, and on to item two.
Item two
comes to us from Vice.com, which, by the way, Vice.com, terrific journalism and terrific documentaries. If you ever get a chance to see any of them, headline in this item on Vice.com reads, I dove into polyamory and haven't looked back. Young divorces on ending their early marriages. In this piece, the writer asked 20-something divorcees what it's like getting married and to be divorced by age 30. So we don't often talk about this demographic of people getting divorced. Your thoughts, Evan?
Yeah, Dave, you took the words right out of my mouth. You're spot on. Look, you're really bringing the heat, starting with Drake. And now we get into the much talked about topic of the polyamory relationship. Look, the article gets into the topic, and dare I say, increasing trend of young couples getting married in their 20s and divorce very quickly before they hit 30. And there's a line in this article that says, fuck the conventions of matrimony. Mm. So, Dave, let me ask you, is society leaning away from the traditional, conventional marriage? And this idea that marriage is the peak of the mountain that everyone has to aspire to climb towards?
It's odd because it's counterintuitive based on a trend that we have been led to believe, at least in years recent past, and that is that the younger generation, the millennials, were waiting to get married. And you would think that if they were waiting to get married, that they were willing to place maybe even more value on the institution of marriage. And now, maybe not so. So it's, if this is the trend, that's, it's not a good trend, of course, but I don't know. This generation, Evan, I don't understand these kids today. So I hope they're not doing it. But I think, you know, Evan, people that come to you, they probably don't fall into any class. There are young people that get divorced quickly. There are young people that will be married 10 or 12 years and then get divorced. And then there are the gray divorces. So you correct me if I'm wrong, but they're all over the book.
Yeah. No, look, you're spot on. We see the full gamut, people in their 20s, people in their 70s. And we talked about on the podcast before, Dave, during the pandemic and even following the pandemic, there was a big trend in gray divorce. People are living longer, life expectancies longer, people wanting different things, doing different things. So we're really seeing both sides of the spectrum.
Very good. Next item comes to us from the Wall Street Journal.
Item 3.
Headline in the journal reads, How to Fix Your Marriage in 16 Hours. So-called high-impact couples therapy is costly, intense, and, its fans say, more effective than traditional counseling. I hadn't heard of this before, Evan. I don't know if you have, but love to hear your insights.
So I want to start by rereading the title of this article. How to Fix Your Marriage in 16 Hours. That's right, Dave. 16 hours. You heard me right. I'll say it again. 16 hours. Now, look, I hope no one listening to this while they're driving drove off the road. And look, I'm going to be honest. I'm sort of struggling with this, right? And I'm trying to keep an open mind. I'm trying to buy into this idea that your marriage can be fixed through high-impact couples therapy in just 16 hours. And I know people swear by it. I've had clients of mine swear by it. I know people who take the plunge into these 16 hours of intense couples therapy. They swear by it. And the article specifically references people whose marriage was on the rocks and this type of therapy saved them and saved their marriages. And maybe it's true. Maybe there's something to be said for this. And I'm open, like I said, to being convinced it works in the short term. But my question is, what about the long term? And that's where I think traditional therapy, which I'm a huge believer in, is so necessary, because I can't necessarily at this moment subscribe to the theory that 16 hours fixes it all. And look, things are going to come up in the future. There's bumps, there's highs, there's lows going forward. And yes, intensive couples therapy may help you to deal with those issues, but I still believe in the traditional therapy model to supplement it and for people to have an ongoing outlet going forward in their marriages and relationships.
Yeah.
What's your thought?
I'm with you that I wouldn't want to poo-poo it if it's working for some people, to just really like anything else. And there might be something to it in that if you go into this intense couples therapy, I'm willing to believe it's possible that you have a moment of enlightenment. And I'm thinking about something that couples struggle with: communication. So maybe in this therapy, it's like, wow, you never said that to me before. Or you get questions answered that, like, you know what? Every Sunday I make breakfast, get up and make breakfast for the kids. How come you never do that? I mean, maybe it's just a question. And maybe the answer is, well, because I thought you liked doing it. And they just never communicated it. So I think it's maybe a great way to kickstart communication. But people do change. And so, like, a year after this couples therapy, I hope that they still continue to either do some kind of therapy or just keep the channels of communication open in some way. Maybe it was the nucleus of it was that couples therapy that kickstarted it, that blew it up. But the game's not over. It's never over.
No, Dave, I'll just add one thing. As you were talking, this came to mind.
Yep.
If you're going into this 16 hours of couples therapy, you want to be there, right? That's one of the concerns that people have with couples therapy in the traditional sense, that sometimes one person is going through the motions. Sometimes one person is just doing it to appease the other person. If you're entering this intense 16 hours, that's the only thing you're focusing on. You have to be a willing participant. Correct me if I'm wrong. I don't think you can fake your way through an intense 16 hours of straight intensive couples therapy. I don't think you can do that.
It's a good point. And it's kind of you're forced to come to the table. And if you do try to fake it for 16 hours, then you're not invested in the marriage, right? Then you really are just kidding yourself. So is it 16 hours in a row? Do you get to sleep or do you get to go to the bathroom or anything like that? I don't know.
These are great questions. These are great questions. Look, that's one way to get people closer together, right?
That's right. All right. We are up to the portion of the program where we hear from you, the listener. It is time once again for Ask Evan.
Ask Evan.
Ask Evan.
Ask Evan.
Ask Evan, where we hear from you, and in this case, we hear from Mary from Queens, New York. She writes the following. Dear Evan, my spouse and I are headed for a divorce, and I am hoping it will be amicable. I earn roughly twice as much as my spouse. I have no idea how much alimony I will be expected to pay or child support for our two teenage sons. Where do I begin trying to budget for this?
Mary, great question, and I hope your divorce is amicable too. The fact that you want it to be amicable says a lot, and that's a great thing. Regarding the finances and what you can expect, planning and being prepared are the absolute keys to have a successful and amicable divorce. Know your options, know your expenses, know what they're going to look like in the short term and long term. The way you're thinking about this already is the right way, but also keep something in mind. You don't need to figure this out alone. There's great resources out there. And one of my favorite sayings is really rings true. Divorce is a true team sport, and it applies to you and your situation. You don't need to prepare alone. Start putting your team together, starting with a divorce attorney. And let me say this, find a divorce attorney who shares an approach for divorcing that fits your goals and what you're looking for. And then also look into other professionals, such as a divorce financial coach and therapist and some other wonderful professionals. And keep in mind, anytime you're divorced or you feel like your divorce is going astray from your goal of having it be amicable, take a step back, keep in mind your goals, and try with the assistance of your attorney to bring it back to a place where everyone is aligned to proceed in an amicable way.
That's another edition of Ask Evan. If you want to submit a question for Evan to answer on the podcast, email producer Dave at david@pod617.com.
Our featured guests on this week's episode of the Shine On Podcast are Lisa Johnson and Chris Barry. Lisa and Chris are the co-founders of Been There, Got Out, and they are high-conflict divorce coaches. They co-author the absolute must-read book, Been There, Got Out, Toxic Relationships, High-Conflict Divorce, and How to Stay Sane Under Insane Circumstances, which was released in March 2023. Welcome both to the Shine On Podcast. It's great to have you with us.
Thank you, Evan.
Thank you so much.
And Lisa, I want to start with you and ask you, how does someone know whether a relationship is toxic or just has some typical stress involved?
You're asking someone who was in a relationship for 20 years, highly educated, did not realize that it was an emotionally abusive relationship. A lot of what we see is hidden a lot of times in these situations, especially financial abuse, where someone doesn't have access to information. So a lot of it involves not really knowing what's going on, not understanding the dynamics of emotional abuse, which can be also lying by omission. Again, not having access to all the information. In my own situation, my ex was living a double life for 20 years that I wasn't aware of. And later on, people have said, was it really that bad if you don't know about it? Yes, it is, because then you don't have agency and you can't make choices. But it's hard to say like what's just little things and what's like really bad. But I can compare it to my healthy relationship of being with somebody who actually cares about how I feel, who communicates really well.
Who is he? I'll kill him. Oh, you're talking about me.
Oh. You're so corny. Yeah, but I mean, when you can work through, like, everybody argues, and I think conflict is necessary in a relationship. We talk about coercive control often with our clients, and coercive control is a situation where there's no conflict allowed. And that happens when one person's needs and desires and wishes are basically ignored. So that's not healthy. Like, not fighting at all or not having conflict is not healthy, but being able to work through issues together and understand that you're not one person. So people have different desires, and anyone that can work through conflict, I think that's okay, but it's a whole new level. And we don't just deal with like little stuff. We deal with extremely high conflict.
And I love that you led with that question, because the people we work with, across the board, are the kindest, most loyal, creative, honest, loving, fill in any nice word. That's the reason they were targeted, right? And the people, the abusers, the other side of that usually former partnership, they're highly skilled manipulators. They've been honing their craft since adolescence usually. And they don't come in and say like, hey, I've got some really good traits, but you should know I'm abusive. And so this is going to end very badly. So would you like to go out for coffee? You're like, that's not how it starts, right? It's almost like we use the analogy, the frog in the pot, right? Where the heat gets turned up very slowly, almost to the point where you don't notice. And I remember being in my own difficult, toxic relationship where I kept telling myself, they always say marriage is hard. That must be what this is. This is what they meant. Man, I didn't realize it was this hard. But it's really hard, and I'm going to persevere and stick through it.
Right. Like, I'll do anything to keep it together. And then at what point is it like, this is just, no, too much.
And you both mentioned some incredibly important points. And Lisa, we're going to get to coercive control, manipulation, and all that stuff. But Chris, I want to ask you, Lisa mentions all the wonderful things about her new relationship. And I have to ask you, what is it like to have both a professional and a personal relationship? And tell us about, you guys ever fight?
Oh, sure, we fight. We fight, but very infrequently. And as Lisa said, I think some fighting is healthy. I have friends who when I'll tell them, like, Lisa and I have been together 9 years as a couple, just about, and we work together and I see her all day long. And they're like, oh my God, like that must be, I would never want that. Like, that's awful. And I'm like, I love it. I love it because we wear different hats, right? And if anything, the work creeps into the personal instead of vice versa. So here we are during the day building this business together and learning. We learn every day from our clients in other places. We're doing so. It's really creative. Building a business is really creative, especially a business in an area that there really aren't a lot of people. There's nobody we know of doing exactly what we do. There are very few people doing things even close to what we do. So it's been a really cool journey, and to get to work on something creative with the love of my life every single day is awesome. I'm not sick of it yet.
Yeah, it's so rewarding what we do, and to be able to share that. I mean, first of all, our career and our lives are filled with other people's drama. So we've got great stories. We take long car rides together, and we always have loads to talk about. And it was like that even before we started Been There, Got Out. But it is really rewarding because our clients make so much progress, and to be part of that together and say like, did you notice that? And did you see that? And that's so cool. Like, we just love it.
That's great. And yeah. Lisa, Chris, I hear from so many of my clients as a divorce attorney, and I deal with people going through divorce, high conflict, custody battles, and really high conflict relationships. And for many people, they think when they're divorced that it's over, right? But in many ways, when you share children together, it really just begins. So give us some strategies for how parents can navigate a co-parenting relationship when there's a high conflict spouse, high conflict relationship, and really someone who uses a party's divorce agreement and the process that's set forth in that agreement to further the control aspect in the dynamic in the relationship.
Sure. Right. So,
so you go first, Chris?
Weaponizing the agreement. For sure. So one of the things that we do, and this is an area of focus for me, is writing high conflict parenting plans, because really that's the, so when the, just stepping back for a second, when the relationship ends, and especially once the divorce is over, the abusive party doesn't really have day-to-day control and an ability to exert power and control over the target. So they're really, it's not like they give up and walk away, right? They hone their, they narrow their focus down to, usually it's kids, money, and the courts. And the money and the courts are tied together. The kids are the one that's like the worst, right? They just want to continue to exert power and control, and they don't care who gets hurt in the process. They don't even need to win. They just want to fight. So one of the best things you can do is get a parenting plan that is way, way detailed, has deadlines and consequences, and anticipates different contingencies, because it's not like a normal divorce where, sure, everybody's angry, something is tearing apart the marriage, and there's resentment, maybe there was cheating, whatever it was. Something tore it apart and the parties are angry, but after a year, year and a half, 2 years, and then after the divorce is over, and in the practice of co-parenting, people settle down. I don't want to fight anymore. I'm looking forward in my life. Let's put the kids first. Most people can get there, but in the high conflict, they can't. So that would be my number one, is make sure whatever agreement, and this extends to financial as well, but especially parenting plans, that they are super, super detailed and cover everything. And you're still going to miss stuff, but try to cover everything.
And just to clarify that, when Chris says super detailed, he doesn't mean like a 60-page agreement. He means no gray language. He means like airtight, enforceable things, and making sure that a client understands what is actually enforceable and what really doesn't matter. Because people get all excited about something, for example, like the right of first refusal. And then you go in, like a judge doesn't want to hear about like, oh, I was supposed to be able to babysit. So we do a lot of clarifying that. But for me, we just call, like, divorce is just part one. It took a year for my divorce. I was like, when I get divorced, I'll finally have some relief. No, that was the beginning of a whole new chapter. And it's the same for our clients. So because Chris and I specialize in legal abuse, it's where the people are weaponizing the legal system to wear the other side down and bleed them dry. And a lot of that litigation comes post-judgment. We teach something called strategic communication. And our backgrounds, mine in particular, I was a high school English teacher. I'm a professional writer. And I love teaching the art of persuasion, which is what we do through writing as well as speaking. We do a lot with debate and the art of rhetoric. And so when we teach strategic communication, we always say, you have to constantly plan that you might be back in court. So strategic communication, we're going to teach you a system where you're writing to your ex, but you're really writing for the invisible audience of a judge, custody evaluator, mediator, AFC, attorney for the child, whoever. And the goal is to document that other person's patterns of behavior over time and the impact it has on your child, as well as your relationship with your child. And that has to connect to as like best interest factors. And then we deal a lot with what we call the alienation factor, since our clients are often accused of parental alienation. So we want them to really understand what that means and not be afraid of it, but also make sure that they're not inadvertently doing it, because there's so many ways you can do things, even just with body language, that can be that you don't even know, oh, I shouldn't be doing that. So we want to, a lot of what we do is educate people. So also strategic communication effectively prevents that parental alienation claim from, we say, getting talons in you, because you understand what it means. You'll make sure not to do it. But it starts turning the power dynamic around in the relationship. And it turns, we say, hearsay into evidence, because for you to come in and say, this person did this, 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 that's just what you're saying. But when you have a written, you have a written record of communication between you and your ex, that's something, at least in our experiences, that judges tend to accept and really look at. And we also, we really we really push that people try to use parenting apps. We just came from an amicable divorce network conference in Nashville, and there was a guy from one of the parenting apps that was talking about how AI has really affected communication and court exhibits, and how email and text can be manipulated. So we really encourage parenting apps to be part of that strategic communication.
And Lisa, you mentioned the term legal abuse. How do you define it, and how can individuals recognize it in their own relationships?
Okay, so that's basically, I mean, I think about what a judge said in my own situation of being in court for 9 years and about 100 court appearances in 2 states and representing myself successfully for 6 years, and getting great orders, but taking 4 years to actually get them enforced. So we talk about how somebody is using the legal system to basically, like I said, wear the other person down and often bleed them dry financially. And there's two main ways that we see legal abuse happening. One is vexatious litigation, or someone's filing frivolous motions, and the other party is forced to constantly return to court to deal with issues, often like, you're an unfit parent, I'm going to take the kids away from you. So all these threats. So our clients are living in a constant state of dread, and they're taking time away from their job, their parenting. They're spending tons of money on lawyers to deal. Just it's like the constantly things are being thrown at them. They develop all kinds of health issues related to the stress of being served papers all the time, opening up emails. It's like, oh my gosh, what's going to happen next? Like living in dread for years. The other side of that is what I was dealing with. And my wonderful divorce attorney knew this was going to happen, and I had no idea what I was in for, but he said, your ex is not going to comply with court orders. And so all these years in court have been me having to go after my ex to comply with our divorce agreement and trying to get the court to enforce those orders, which I was able to do, but we had a lot of what we know are called kick the can judges who are like, oh, and then judges switch and you switch states. And so it's like always trying to catch people up and say, this is what I need and this is why I'm entitled to it. And then asking the judge to put deadlines and consequences in, and what are the penalties going to be, and why am I entitled to this, and on and on and on. And so finally, it happened. I was able to get excellent enforcement, but of course, there was a lot of suffering along the way, as well as an excellent education for me.
Right? Chris, go ahead.
I think back, because a lot of the times that Lisa was in court, I would go there with her for emotional support. A lot of times I wasn't allowed in, but I'd sit out in the waiting area once she went in, and I would talk to her. I'd say, this is going to be the day you finally are going to get the judge to hear you and all that. And I'd sit there for a half hour, an hour, and she'd come back in and her head would be hung low, shaking it. Nope, not today. And what happens is, as Lisa said, you just get worn down from having to go back and go back and go back. But also, when courts don't enforce their own orders, it emboldens the other side. So they say, wait a minute, because most people, like I've had times when a judge has ordered me to do something and I've been like, holy cow, I better do this. Like the next day,
sure,
I'm making sure that I comply because it's a judge and I'm a law abiding citizen. Right. But as soon as they realize they can get away with this stuff, they get braver and they get even more above the law. They comply with less stuff, and it just makes the matter. It snowballs.
Mm-hmm. And so, Chris, let me ask you about that. Is it a system problem? Is it a judge problem? Is it a lack of understanding from the judicial perspective as to what legal abuse is, what non-physical form of domestic violence really is? Where is the problem, or is it all of the above?
It is absolutely all of the above. These cases are exceptions. These are like 5 to 10%, give or take, of all divorces are what would be called high conflict. So they don't follow the normal pattern. Like I think this is better for you, but family law attorneys, I get the sense that there's like a rhythm to a divorce. People are angry, then they settle down, then they realize there's going to be the range of possible outcomes, whether it's custody, financial, or something else, is kind of a narrow range. It's going to end up somewhere in here. So everybody's better off if we can all reach a reasonable solution. And in enough time, you get there. So I find that, or we find that, family law attorneys are confused. A lot of times our clients will say, My lawyer said this is the craziest case they've ever seen.
Yeah.
Right. They don't, it goes off script, right?
That's our club.
The family law attorneys, they don't have, and the ones that a lot of our people come to us and say, I need to find an attorney that understands fill in the blank, narcissism, borderline, sure, whatever the core issue is. And we say, no, you don't. You just need to have a bigger, more active role in your case because your attorney is not an expert in this stuff. Those kinds of attorneys are few and far between. We call them unicorns. We find them. We're thrilled to find them. But so, and of course, family law judges, before they became family law judges, they were lawyers, right? And probably family lawyers. So when family lawyers who don't understand, because they're not, they don't have a psychology background, I understand why they don't understand, they become family lawyers and they also don't understand it. So they tend to say it takes two to tango. These two are difficult.
And Lisa, you talk about your own experience and going back to court and looking for compliance with court order after court order and the endless litigation, 9 years, the hundreds of appearances. Tell us why you represented yourself in your situation, and would you recommend that to others?
Okay. So I had a wonderful divorce attorney who became my best friend for a year, but I paid him $100,000 that I'm paying back for decades. And I never expected anything like that. I stayed in that marriage longer because I was like, I don't have $10,000 to get a divorce. No idea that it would get to that point. So at the end of the divorce, my lovely attorney said, your ex is not going to comply and you're going to have to go back and do this yourself. So you might as well start learning now how to do that and start establishing a paper trail. So he gave me some ideas on what to do. I have to say that my dad and uncle are identical twins in White Plains and they are patent attorneys. So I do have people in the family that speak legalese, even though they know nothing about family law. It just was helpful to always have like some lawyer in the background to help with certain things. So my divorce attorney said, you're going to have to do it yourself. I'm here if you need me, but you can't afford me because he's just going to decimate you financially. So that's what really started my journey. I didn't believe, I kept saying to my attorney, like, why do I have to do this? My attorney was saying, you got to make sure you establish that paper trail of trying to involve your ex in the educational process. Cause at that point it was stuff with college before my kids went And I said, but he doesn't care. He's not involved. My lawyer just said, you need to do this because you need to appear a certain way when you get to court. And luckily I listened, I had a wonderful paper trail. And I also always used attorneys, and we still do, we always use attorneys in the background because going pro se, there's different ways to do it. Like we talk about using limited scope attorneys, either you can do a lot yourself and then the attorney can present for you. But most of the time, like with myself and a number of our clients, they have attorneys helping them in the background with procedure and preparing paperwork, but then they present themselves. So we know from talking to attorneys that at this point, usually 3 out of 4 litigants tend to be pro se because of the cost. It's just crazy. And a number of our clients end up having to go pro se because they've spent hundreds of thousands of dollars. And if they don't give up, they don't have any other option. So we try to encourage them to use as much free or limited scope options that there are. But we always say, if you're going to be pro se, you need to have a lawyer who can advise you because you don't want to mess things up by doing things improperly procedurally. But basically that's why I did it. And luckily I went up to the appellate level. I'm not sure if you know this, but my ex appealed 4 times. And in Connecticut, they have a retired appellate judge that talks to both parties to try and keep you out. And they say, like, who's going to win? And sure. And when he talked to me alone, he said, Lisa, this is not like family court. This is very serious and you really should have an attorney. And I said, look, I have been doing this for years. I am not flying solo. I have background people helping me, but I'm going to do it. And I did it before the appellate court myself, and I won, and my case is published in the Connecticut Law Journal. And I always say that I think that's a big honor for any attorney, and I'm not an attorney. So attorneys are usually like, oh my gosh, I've never heard of that. So I'm always like, well, I'm happy to do that. But I think that it is very difficult to go pro se. It takes a certain constitution. And I know some of our attorney friends have said, oh, I love going against pro ses because I could get under their skin and get them really emotional and knock them off balance. So a lot of what we do with our pro se clients is get them ready and say, you are going to be bullied. This is going to happen. We need to anticipate this and prepare properly on top of getting everything organized and knowing what to expect and knowing that you're, for example, not supposed to look at opposing, like look at the judge. You're taught everything you're saying, you're talking to the judge, not to them. So this is what you need to focus on, paying attention to body language, understanding that in our experience and our clients' experience, it's like a crazy circus and you have to learn to pivot all the time and you got to be ready. And we always say it's like you're paying $6 million for a 30-second Super Bowl commercial. So you have to be on point and focused and know what matters and what doesn't. And of course, there's a lot involved. But
that last part is so, so important because the people we work with, they were targets of abuse. A lot of them have complex PTSD or other issues, or like in my case, and the sort of shame associated with our societal values of me being a male and being an abuse target and all that. Let's set that aside for a moment, just for anybody who's been through that kind of thing, to be in the presence of their abusive ex and also be in a courtroom. For me, I had a lot of really traumatic experiences in the courtroom. My ex had a bully attorney. My divorce took 3 years. I took a lot of body blows in that time. So Lisa once said to me, you can never go pro se. And I am not gloating or anything like that. But I recently did. 2 weeks ago today, I was in court and I was successful. I won my motion. And it's not that Lisa was wrong. At the time that she said I could never go pro se, I was in no shape. I would get brain fog, I would lock up, I would tremble, whatever, when I was in that setting. But I healed. I worked on myself and I healed. And by the time I went back and was pro se, I was able to do it. So a lot of, as Lisa touched on, a lot of what we do is get people as best as possible to be in the right mindset.
And both of your stories are such credits to each of you and the pursuit and your hard work and focus. And now you're using that to help so many people who are in similar situations, really difficult situations. I want to ask you, and Lisa, I'll turn to you. What advice would you give someone who fears that they have a friend who's in a toxic and abusive relationship?
Oh, we just did like content on it. It's really hard because people feel so helpless when they see a loved one going through it. You have to understand that the thing that feels like you want to do, like you want to tell the person, can't you see, like, this is really bad. But by doing that, it actually makes it worse because a person in that situation already is isolated, usually by a partner. And when you come to your friend or loved one and you say that person's trying to hurt you, like, can't you see it, they feel like that you don't understand them, and then they're likely to go tell the other person, and that person will isolate them further and say, see, they just don't like me. And so it makes matters worse. So a lot of it involves just trying to be really patient. Like, people really don't understand what it's like. No matter how smart the other person is, there's a lot of stuff that goes on. There's a lot of things that affect people from their childhood. We often gravitate towards situations that are familiar. It's so complex that the best thing you can do is just let your friend or loved one know, like, I'm here whenever you need me. And to try not to be judgmental, because even like people say things to people they love and to me and to our clients as well that are so harmful, and they don't mean to do it. They'll be like, but why did you stay so long? But what, it couldn't have been that bad. And it's just like, oh, like they're already feeling so awful that saying things like that just make it worse. And when you share children with somebody like that, getting away is way, I mean, I'm a state certified domestic violence advocate too. Like, it takes an average of 7 to 9 times to get out. And those can be like really difficult experience of just those attempts. But when you have kids, sometimes your own kids are making it harder because they're put in these loyalty conflicts, where I know with my own situation, I was warned, and not that I would give this advice to everyone, but I was told, you better tell the kids the truth, which we did with my ex was there too. But they said, if you don't tell the kids the truth, your ex is going to spin it that you're the one breaking up the family. And then the kids are going to blame you. So there's so many other dynamics. It's really, really difficult. And so the best thing you can do is just try to be patient with the person and realize that it's there's so much more than you could possibly understand unless you've been through it yourself.
Right. Listen and validate. And what adds a layer of difficulty to that is, so these stories are so crazy. They don't sound real, some of them. I'm thinking, Lisa, and there are so many stories we can pull out, but we have a client who happens to be an attorney, different kind of attorney, very, very successful. And what I think, Columbia educated?
Columbia Law School, yeah.
Columbia Law School.
High powered.
And her ex kept her and the kids living in a basement in their house. And he's boarded up all the windows and took out all the light bulbs so they wouldn't have any light. And that was her normal. Wow. That had become her normal. If she told that to someone, I would hope that person she told it to would listen and validate and understand and not say, that sounds crazy. Why don't you just leave? Like, yeah, those are the
you of all people. Yeah.
You seem too smart and educated for that, or disbelieving. That's yeah. Those are the things you really don't want to do.
Right.
And Chris, let me, using the story that you just mentioned and the example, how did the two of you protect yourselves from being triggered or re-traumatized by situations just like that you encounter on a daily basis in your work?
Yeah, that is an excellent question. I'm going to get to the answer, which is probably I don't know, but it was a big, big concern when we first, this started as a book project and kind of took some different twists and turns before we got back to the book, but we got into the strategizing and coaching area. I had my doubts. I said, I this stuff might re-trigger me. I don't know if I can do this. But what I've found, and I think there are a lot of parallels between what we do and like 12-step programs and addiction and things like that. And if you know anything about that world, one of the ways that addicts are helped in their recovery is by helping others, right? And like alcoholics would have a sponsor, right, that would help them. That's what it's like for us. I find that helping people helps me heal. I don't know where I'd be on my timeline if we weren't in this business, but I love what we do, and it helps me so much.
Right. We see so much progress. Like, our clients do really, really well. And we always point out that often it's like, it's not like some huge win, but it's like, look at how much you've changed since we just met you just a couple of weeks ago, like in learning how to communicate. And they're like, yeah, I used to go crazy over those kinds of things. And what's really cool is sometimes our attorneys tend to feel the injustice even harder, because they're like trained in, this is the justice system. Like, I can't believe in the court that I work in, it's nothing like this, blah, blah, blah. And some of our attorneys tend to like have a really hard time with communicating. And so I love like pointing out to them, like, look at that. Because a lot of our people also, their careers have been weaponized. Like, oh, if you're so smart and you're a psychologist, and then how could I be an abuser? You must be an idiot for not seeing that, or else I'm not really an abuser. So to help them sort of remember who they were before these difficult relationships, and recognize how intelligent they are and how they've been able to use their intelligence and how they're moving forward. Like, that is such a wonderful feeling.
Right, Lisa, I'm thinking of, you reminded me of another client who just so happens to also be an attorney. I swear we don't only work with attorneys.
No, this is great, because I was going to ask you both about success stories or memorable moments. Yeah.
This woman, she came to us, she was shell-shocked. She was just lost. And she was talking about how she really struggled communicating. Her ex had told her, if you know what gaslighting is, this is gaslighting, had told her that she was a terrible communicator. And we're like, wait a minute, you're an attorney. All you do all day long is communicate with other people. You're not a terrible communication. And she was like, oh yeah, Like, that's right. I'm very good at this. Like, his the reality that my ex tried to put on me is not the reality that the rest of us are experiencing every day.
A question for both of you. Lisa, through the ups and downs of your career, your personal journey, everything that you went through, what's the best advice you've ever been given?
The best advice overall?
Yeah. If one particular piece of advice stands out.
Okay. So I'm thinking about something that we often say to our clients, and that's that you probably, our clients never lose. They just give up too soon. So a lot of it is that whatever you're going through, especially in this realm, is it's so important to get support. You need support. This is really, really hard. No matter how smart and successful you are, you still need people to help you get through it. And to that, there's like the, it's so much better on the other side. But it's going to take a while to get there. But even in the midst of it, it's possible to have this amazing life, because you can't afford to wait for everything to be fine. Like, it's never going to be fine. And then I remind them that I've been doing this long. Like, when they're like, oh my God, you've been 9, 10 years. Like, I can't. I'm like, you can, because during this time, I met the love of my life. I found this incredible career using my educational background now on a global level. My kids are doing really well. Like, I couldn't have imagined this when I was like back in the days when I was still with my ex, feeling like I would do anything to keep that relationship together. And oh my gosh, if I get a divorce, like I'm going to destroy our intact family. I'm terrified, like walking around with a ball of pain in the pit of my stomach. It was so frightening. And then finally being like, it's worse staying than it is to take the chance and go. Like, that was the best decision, one of the best decisions I've ever made. Because every day now, Chris and I talk about how grateful, it sounds really cheesy, but how grateful we are. I'm just like, oh, the contrast. Wow. Like, and also we have to think about, it's not just ourselves, but for our children and what we're modeling. Like, when we stay in these difficult, abusive relationships, no matter what we tell our children, they're going to gravitate towards what's familiar. And so we're modeling a bad situation by staying in there and thinking that the kids don't know what's going on. They know, and that's what they're going to go towards in their future relationships. So is that what you want for your children? Do you want them to keep repeating these cycles? Because you have an opportunity to basically change the cycle of intergenerational trauma. So why not get the right support? Certainly, it's not like you just go on a whim. Like, you really need to educate yourself and understand what you're doing and strategize and talk to people that get it. There's a time to do your research and understanding what the disorder might be that your ex has, but then there's a time to stop that and work on moving forward and not getting stuck in like a trauma loop. We always advise people not to doom scroll, to look at all the terrible news, because that just like reiterates how terrible things are, and sure, to make them feel powerless. It's important to really get in the right mindset and again, find professionals that understand what you're dealing with and can effectively guide you through and out of it.
Yeah, I'll give two quick ones. One is, I used to work in a totally different field. I was in corporate IT years ago, and I worked for a German chemicals company. And my manager, who is one of the two professional like mentors that I look up to, I've had in my career, when anybody would propose some kind of a project, he would say, pause. How does this project, if we do this, how does this help our company make and sell chemicals? It was like the acid test, right? And so I think there's a lot to be learned from that in terms of understanding what your goal is. There are so many distractions when you're dealing with these kinds of cases and going through a high conflict divorce and custody battle and everything that comes out of that. There are so many distractions. So it's really important to focus and say, what's my goal? And every single thing before I go and put effort into it, or for example, get a psychological evaluation or whatever it is, whatever thing is, it was right in front of me. Before I do that, invest in it. How does this help me get to a solution that I can live with? So always keep your eye on the goal.
And for the two of you, you found one another. You fell in love, found a career, all wonderful things. But the journey, the process, was challenging, hard, difficult. You could substitute any word you want. It was not easy. Do you have any regrets in terms of past relationships, the process, the court process, as you learn and look back now that you help others? Are there things that you would do differently?
Oh, sure. 100% for me. Well, first of all, so I want to answer that in two different ways. When you asked about relationships, there's a lot of shame associated with being the target of abuse and staying in an abusive relationship for a long time. I was married to my ex for almost 10 years. I was in the relationship for almost 14. And how could I have been so stupid and all of that stuff? And that when I start down that path, and I really don't do it anymore, but during the recovery process, I would only get as far as my kids. I have two sons, they're 20 and 17 now. And without that relationship, I don't have those kids. And I would go, I always used to joke, I would walk through hell and back for my kids, and every day my ex makes me prove it. But as far as with the legal process, I made a ton of mistakes. I didn't know anything when I was starting. And like all people or most people in my situation, I made the mistake of using my very, very expensive attorney as a therapist to like help me emotionally, which was not their role. There was a lot I did not know enough to take more of a leadership role and say like, hey, maybe we should do this. Maybe we should do that. Maybe we should stop like drafting agreements that are never going to get signed, because that's where probably half of the $300,000 my divorce cost for no reason. That's where it went, right? Because the other side had no intention of negotiating in good faith. So there were a lot of things that if there were a time machine, I'd go back and do differently. But to be able to apply that knowledge now to help others avoid those same mistakes, it was worth it. It was worth it. So I'm, in a weird way, I'm glad I made those mistakes, because without that experience, I wouldn't be able to help people the way I can now.
Lisa, what about you?
Yeah, I mean, when Chris was describing my face coming out of all of those hearings where we got nowhere, I remember just being like, stop saying it, you're jinxing me. And I get so frustrated, like so mad. And I remember just like every day being like, please, like, let this be the day. But I don't have regrets, because looking back, like, it gave me such tremendous empathy. And I think going through all of that brought us so much closer to what our clients are experiencing. And it makes us be able to do I think we do a great job. And so it's like, I don't remember a lot of that stuff. I do, like, now I'm happy. People are always like, why are you smiling all the time? I feel so bad for you. I'm like, no, I'm great. Like, I'm great. So I don't wish it on anybody, but I don't really have regrets. I also have two amazing kids. And sometimes I'm like, gosh, it's so weird that they're half him, but they're like, I love them and adore them. And I can't imagine having anyone better, having better kids than they are. So I'm really glad that I have them. And I can't think of anything that I would have changed.
And Lisa, what you said about us meeting, we met very early, right? When you were what? A few months into your actual divorce, even though you
barely, yeah, right? My marriage ended like 2 years before I actually got him out. There was a lot of stuff.
But we were early. We were very, right. We didn't realize it, but we were very early in the legal process and very early in the recovery from trauma and all of that stuff. And it would have been really, really hard if we didn't just by blind bad luck we're both going through the same thing. If it had only been one of us, I don't know if we would have made it, because it was overwhelming. It was all consuming for a long amount of time, but we were able to support each other and say, oh my God, me too. Like, that's happening in my case too. It's all the same stuff. So we learned together and supported each other.
Yeah, we used to make bets on whose divorce would be finished sooner, not realizing like what came next. It was horrible. Yeah.
But, well, Lisa, yeah. Chris, let's bring on producer Dave for a fun segment we do on the Shine On podcast called They Said It.
Yes, indeed, Evan. We're up to They Said It, where we will hear three famous quotations from famous people, I should say. Let's get into it.
They said it.
They said it.
They said it.
All right. first on They Said It. This quote comes to us from psychologist Asa Dawn Brown, who said the following: toxic relationships are like a good pasta that has been overcooked. Lisa, can we get your reaction first on that quote?
I wouldn't call it good at all. Bad, where do we get good? Good?
Bad,
no.
Bad pasta? We're talking like Sbarro pasta, maybe?
Oh, I'm just thinking toxic relationships. So one of the things are that I'm thinking of is people often say the person wasn't like it when, like that when I met them. And we have to remind them they were always like that, but you just didn't realize it. So I disagree. I don't think there was ever any good pasta.
Nope.
Chris, similar thoughts or what?
Oh, 100%. I mean, I don't know if this is a family show and what kind of language you can use.
It's a podcast. You can swear.
Go right ahead.
No, that would be off brand for us. But okay. No, I'm picturing maybe it's a box that says pasta, like delicious pasta on it. And then you open it and it's your dog that's not house trained properly yet has left you something in there.
Yes, that is a long way from good pasta, for sure.
That's right.
All right, we will move.
Toxic relationships.
We will move to quote number two, which comes to us from therapist Maria Consiglio. And she said the following. Do you know Maria?
Yes. Yeah,
okay. She's kind of all over the internet. She said the following: narcissists are like balloons. They need to be inflated with others' praise and admiration to feel whole. Chris, would you like to go first and give us your reaction to that one?
Yep. This one resonates a lot better. So yeah, narcissists, now we are not professional psychologists. We're not trained mental health professionals, but we do run into this personality type every day. And one of the things is that they have an inability to regulate their own self-esteem. So for example, I'm a golfer. I'm not a great golfer. I'm pretty good though, right? And if you and I went out and played and I played terribly and you said at the end of the day, Chris, you're horrible. You are a terrible golfer. That wouldn't set me into some tailspin emotionally. I'd still know, yeah, I played badly today, but I'm pretty good. I'm good. Like I have that ability to maintain my own self-esteem. Narcissists can't do that. They need to get it from others. Everything is an external source of validation. So I agree with this 100%.
Lisa?
Okay, well, Maria is like our internet friend, and I keep saying, Maria, I have to interview you, and she keeps making excuses, but I'm going to get her one of these days, so we know her. Yep. So I'm looking at this, and I'm thinking, being inflated with others' praise and admiration, this comes up a lot, and I would substitute not just praise and admiration, but attention. And we often tell our clients that it doesn't matter if it's positive or negative attention. When you are giving them your attention, they love it. So that's why it's so important to starve them of your very valuable attention and make them deflate. And I did a whole article on something called a blog a while ago on the narcissistic collapse. And we had like an image of a blobfish. No offense to blobfish, but that's what they just. So, that's my thoughts on this quote.
I have a friend, he's literally just a friend in a group of friends that I think is a classic narcissist. And whenever we do something fun, he spends the next day taking credit for it. Like I planned that whole thing. And whenever he wants to like get us to go on a trip to Florida instead of New Orleans, he'll individually go around to everyone and say, this was my idea. Don't you want to do this? Everybody wants to do this. Everybody wants to do this. And the shame of it is, we keep feeding narcissists, not all of us, but a lot of them do continue to get fed. So I'm going to take your advice. No more.
Well, they can get fed, just not by me, please.
You're right. go somewhere else.
They can have my box of pasta.
They can eat that box of pasta with a spoon. All right. Final quote from They Said It comes to us from poet and storyteller John Mark Green, who said the following: toxic people attach themselves like cinder blocks tied to your ankles and then invite you for a swim in their poisoned waters. Very Jimmy Hoffa here, I guess. Lisa, would you like to react to that one first?
Yeah. All right. So when I saw this, first, I don't know this person, but cinder blocks, they attach themselves. I think of it as like pestilence, like bugs and leeches and all other kinds of things. But we think of them as energy vampires. So not even so much physical, but just they are so draining. And I know that I realized this when my ex finally got out, that when they physically are out of your home and your presence, the air literally lifts. And I like the image of the cinder block, because there is such a heaviness of being associated with people like this. And you do feel a lot lighter. So yeah, that's my thoughts on this one.
Yeah, so I agree from the standpoint of the weight of the cinder block, for sure. That analogy makes sense. But the first thing I was wondering is, what's in it for the cinder block in this example? And if the cinder block is the narcissist, you can be sure there's something in it for the narcissist.
Mm. Right. Absolutely. Well, you've both successfully negotiated this edition of They Said It. You are rewarded with this round of applause from our studio audience. And back to you, Evan, to close things up.
Dave, that was great. And Lisa, Chris, I want to thank both of you for coming on the podcast. Your work, your book, Been There, Got Out, helping so many people go through such incredibly difficult, challenging times. Tell everybody listening where they can get a copy of the book, how they can get in touch with you.
You can just search for Been There, Got Out on Amazon, Been There, Got Out, the book. And it's so easy to find us. Our website's beentheregotout.com. We're all over social media. Just search Been There, Got Out. If you want to reach out for help anytime, you can just contact us through the website or direct message us in Instagram or whatever, but it's just the two of us. And usually it's me that will answer, but just if you're struggling, please reach out. We'd love to help if we could, or we can hopefully connect you to other people that can.
Thank you both for coming on the podcast.
Always a real pleasure.
Season 4, episode 74 of the Shine On podcast. What a show. Two tremendous guests, Lisa Johnson and Chris Barry, co-founders of Been There, Got Out, and they're high conflict divorce coaches and co-authors of the must-read book, Been There, Got Out. Producer Dave, where else can you talk about Drake, your dating life, and the topic of divorce? How great was this show?
It was better than a Drake concert. That's how great it was, Evan.
Ah, Dave, you're the best, and thank you to all the listeners. You can listen to the podcast wherever you get your podcast, Stitcher, Spotify, the best, Boston Podcast Network. Dave, thank you as always. I'm Evan Schein, and I'll talk to you again real soon.